Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics podcast, where we explore politics, economics, and culture here in the Midwest Heartland. This show is distributed by WVIK Public Radio, the flagship national public radio station here in the Quad City region of eastern Iowa and northwestern Illinois. And I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and today our topic is capital punishment. For those of us who are a little older, we remember a time when capital punishment, the death penalty, was far more prevalent in our country than it is in these times. And what happened to cause the pullback in the death penalty? My guest today was a leader in spearheading the reexamination of the death penalty in Illinois, which led to a really remarkable pullback in its practice across the country, and in some places, outright elimination of the death penalty. He's the former governor of Illinois, George Ryan, and he just came out with a book that I recommend folks take a look at. It's called Until I Could Be Sure, How I Stopped the Death Penalty in Illinois. Governor, thank you so much for being our guest today.
Well, thanks for having me, Robin. I'm delighted to have an opportunity to talk with you and your constituents out there.
Well,
in the West.
Yeah, let's first, to set the stage, I think it's important for folks to know who may not remember, or younger listeners out there, kind of your background in politics and where you came from on the ideological spectrum, to give this a little context in how you came to be an opponent of the death penalty.
Well, I live in Kankakee, which is, again, the kind of the central part of the state, on the East Coast, really, with Indiana, but we're about 12 miles from Indiana. But lived here pretty much all my life. I was born in a little town not far from you, I think, called Maquoketa, Iowa.
Yeah, yeah. Very familiar
with it. That's where I was born and left there when I was an infant, a baby, as a matter of fact. And my father worked for Walgreens Drug Company. He graduated from Iowa and got his pharmacy degree, and they sent him to Chicago. He worked there for a while and got transferred to Kankakee, and that's how we got to Kankakee. Been here for most of my life. And had a good education in the public schools, and got a degree in pharmacy from Ferris State College in Michigan, and spent 2 years in the Army in Korea. Came back home, and we had family pharmacies here in Kankakee for about 50 years. We don't have them anymore, but we had family pharmacies. My father was a pharmacist. My brother was a pharmacist. My sister married one, and I are one. Although not anymore.
It's right.
Been a long time since I've done any pharmacy work, but we had 5 stores here in town. And that's where kind of I got my political start, was that I got to meet the family people that came in our drug stores and counseled them, and young mothers and elderly people, about what their needs were. Even had some chats a lot of times about the political scene at the time. So took me to where I was appointed to the Kankakee County Board, where I served for a couple of years and ended up being chairman, and then ran in 1972 for the Illinois House. I got elected 5 times and went on to be the minority leader of the House for 2 years, and then I was Speaker of the House for 2 years, before I went on to become lieutenant governor under Jim Thompson's term. His second term, served 4 terms, I think it was 8 years, I can't remember, yeah, 4 terms as a secretary, lieutenant governor, then went on to be secretary of state, and then from there went to be governor, and that's where I got involved with the death penalty and the actions of the death penalty.
Now, to take folks back,
that's kind of the nutshell, Robert.
Yeah. Yeah, 1972 was the year, I believe, where the death penalty, the Supreme Court in Furman versus Georgia ruled the death penalty unconstitutional. But
right, it was 72.
Case you mentioned in 76 reinstituted the death penalty. The court gave allowed states to do it, and you were really at that time in favor of bringing the death penalty back.
Yeah, I mean, I was for the death penalty, for a long time, most of my life. I tell a lot of people, when you run for public office, nobody wants to, that's running wants to look like they're soft on crime. So everybody's generally being, if you didn't support the death penalty, why, you were kind of soft on crime. And that's how I got involved in it. As a matter of fact, it was the vote to reinstate the death penalty after the Supreme Court gave the go-ahead to the states to reinstitute the death penalty in their states. I was on the floor of the House at the time when the bill came up for a vote. And I flipped on my green switch and voted for it. When a Democrat member by the name of Bob Mann from Chicago was an anti-death penalty guy, and he got up and he said, for those of you that are voting green here today, I'd like to know how many of you would be willing to throw the switch. And it gave me a little pause for thought, and I thought about it and said, well, I don't really want to throw the switch, never don't think I would ever do that, but I think we need to have the law, and so I continued to vote for it. Little did I know that some 20 years later, I'd be in control of the switch.
Yeah.
And, that's how I got to be for the death penalty, and what really triggered my attention was, you know, when you run for office, you get questionnaires from everybody.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of organizations that want to know how you feel about things. And there's always a questionnaire from somebody about, do you favor the death penalty? And I always marked, yes, I did. I thought it was necessary. We should have it. But when you're out campaigning, nobody ever said, hey, Ryan, how do you feel about the death penalty? Most people, at least in the district I lived in, were for the death penalty and thought it was good. So, but it was never a topic. And the people I run against never brought it up because it just wasn't something people were that much interested in at least my legislative district.
Yep.
And until one day after I got elected governor, and it was just a couple of months, I think, I was in the office. I was sitting in the watching television in my living room in the mansion with my wife. And here comes this little guy out on the news named Anthony Porter, who had been convicted of a double murder in a park in Chicago, and convicted and sentenced to the death penalty. And he had been sentenced to die there, and he spent about 16 years on death penalty, waiting to find out what was going on after he'd gone through all of his appeals and the things they go through, and only to find out that the courts exonerated him and said he wasn't guilty, and they had found, thanks to the journalism students from Northwestern University, the real killer. The students at Northwestern, as a class assignment, took up Anthony Porter's cause and started to look for the real killer. They hired a detective to help them, and they found the real guy, a fellow by the name of Al Story Simon, who was living in Wisconsin at the time. And they also hired a private detective to help them. So they had brought Anthony Porter back home and had finally decided that he was innocent after 16 years. And I was watching this on television at the mansion. And I said to my wife, how does that happen in America?
Mm-hmm.
How does somebody get convicted, spend 16 years of their lives every morning when they wake up, say, is today the day they're going to juice me? And this can't be right kind of a punishment. So that's what I started to really look into the death penalty, and that triggered several things that eventually changed my, didn't really change my mind about the death penalty, but it encouraged me to wonder what would happen if the journalism students hadn't helped Anthony Porter. He'd have probably been buried and gone, and nobody would have cared, but he would have been innocent. So that was my cause, to make sure that we didn't execute any innocent people. And I started to make the moves toward doing what I could do to avoid that.
And you soon came face-to-face with the awesome power you had as governor to decide these cases. You mentioned one case in particular, the Chicago Ripper killings, where you wrote very heartfelt about how the night of the execution. But anyway, I'll let you set that story up for our listeners.
Well, he was a terrible guy. His name was Anthony Corchialis. He and his, I think it was one of his brothers and two or three other fellows used to drive around the streets of Chicago and in the area and pick up young women and do everything to him, mutilate him and sexually abuse him. And, through some titanic procedure that they thought that they should be involved in. And they would do all these things to these women and then throw them out. They had a van, and they threw them out on the streets, assumed they were dead. And they threw one lady out, and she wasn't dead. She was alive, and that's how we finally caught up with him and got him arrested. And he was charged, arrested, convicted, and sentenced to die. And the only one. The rest of them got life in prison, basically, which is another reason I wondered, you know, how that could be, but that's the way it worked. And so I proceeded to look at that case pretty good. Had a lot of people that were anti-death penalty and didn't want to be executed. And that was basically, he was Greek. And the Greek church sent the archdiocese of the Greek church in, and you know, he was after me every day almost to talk about it and to plead not to execute him. Plus a lot of other pressures that I had from other people that were anti-death penalty people. And so it gave me a lot of pause, a lot to think about. Here we had a guy, Anthony Porter, spent 16 years in jail, found guilty by a jury and sentenced to die. And if we hadn't had the journalism students from Northwestern, it wasn't the system that saved him. It was just a coincidence that the journalism students got the assignment. And so I wondered that about Karkialis. I mean, I read all of his case and studied his file. And, you know, I didn't find anything that was really to relieve the death penalty, but I guess I was kind of looking for something so I wouldn't have to be the guy that pulled the switch on him. But I took everything into consideration and finally decided that he probably ought to be executed and didn't have another thought about it. And said, well, I did have a lot of thoughts about it, frankly, but I went ahead and executed him. And it's one of those things that kind of sticks with you, you know. It's,
sure.
The pharmacist from Kankakee have the power to say you're going to kill a man is not a pleasant thing to do. But we did it. And it's over, but it's one of those things I live with a lot.
That kind of really seemed like a turning point where you had that power to decide life or death, and that when that opportunity came up again, it just seemed like you were more determined to really dig deeper and, you know, take a close look at the entire system here and how it works. And you were really surprised at what you found.
Yeah, and then, you know, when I look at what's going on today in the Justice Department and how things are handled, I'm not surprised. It looks like there's a lot of corruption there.
Mm-hmm.
With all of these things that we're reading about, how much of it's true and how much isn't, I don't know. But when we're dealing in a penalty that causes, I mean, kills somebody, if you're going to have that kind of a penalty, you better make sure that it works perfectly. And the death penalty will never be able to be worked perfectly. And it's just everything that's involved, from the evidence that's gathered and how, you know, who handled it and who had contact, and all of the things that are involved. There's so many places for error that it's difficult to have. So if we're not going to have a penalty that works safely for 100% of the time, better not have the law.
So you had enormous pressures from both sides, and you talk in the book, and folks should get this book and read it. I mean, it's a very heartfelt, and the tugs that you felt both ways on this issue, meeting with victims' families, meeting with the families of those on death row. Some say, well, you know, hey, 16 years, the system worked on Anthony Porter. The system worked, that the process works. But you were keeping tabs throughout the book on the number of times that capital punishment either led to punishment or exoneration.
Yeah, well, the Tribune came out with a series, investigative series, and they came up with several reasons that the death penalty was flawed. Prosecutorial misconduct, absolutely poor defense attorney, you know, that have been either disbarred or had been alcoholic or drug infected and had the problems trying to defend an innocent person. Black defendants convicted to death by all white juries, just things that just didn't make a lot of sense that could make the death penalty a good reason to do away with the death penalty. Could it be repaired? Well, that's what I thought. So I formed a committee of, I think, 18 people to decide what would improve the death penalty. And by improvement, I meant something that would lessen the possibility of an innocent person being executed. And they studied things and came back with a recommendation that 85 changes that could be made into the law that would make it safer. And so it was an election year. We introduced the bill to the General Assembly, and, of course, nobody wanted to touch it. They don't want to look like they're soft on crime or any of those kind of things. So only one bill passed, and it was in Mike Madigan's chamber in the House. And he passed the bill that requires prosecutors and law enforcement people to videotape all confessions. And that was a good part of the bill. I mean, it was one of those important things that needed to be done. But the other 84 recommendations that we made, it just kind of died on the vine politically, and nobody touched it or picked it up or let it pass or even discussed it much. And, of course, I was gone after that happened. I had finished my term as governor and was back in Kankakee.
So ultimately that led you to just say, because the legislature wouldn't act, to led you to say enough's enough and to take the historic action that you took.
That's exactly right. My fear was, Robin, that I would retire and go home, and I'd pick up the paper some morning to find out some poor innocent guy got executed. That had been on death row. So I figured the only way that I could prevent it and maybe bring some attention to the problems. After I studied the cases of every person on death row, I think it was 167 people, that the best way and only way that I could do that would be to commute the sentences of everybody to life in prison without parole. And that's what I did. And I think to this day I probably did the right thing.
So one important fact that should be pointed out, and you throughout the book, you're keeping track of the number of cases. It started out 11 folks were executed, but 9 were exonerated. And then later on, you talk about 135 death penalty convictions, and more than half were reversed. So it's like half the time there were flaws found either in the process or in the sentence.
And in those cases, they didn't, on the second try, they either were exonerated totally from the second trial or the second attempt, or they were found not sentenced to death, sentenced to life in prison. So it wasn't an easy way to do things, and especially when you're talking about somebody's life.
I found it interesting that you talk about the significant role of the media here and Northwestern University, the classes, in bringing to light a lot of these issues that kind of came about simultaneously as you were reconsidering your viewpoints.
Right, that's exactly right. They were a big help. I don't know what if the Northwestern students hadn't gotten into the Anthony Porter case, he'd probably be dead.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, he's a little guy that. Lived in the neighborhoods, probably did some things he shouldn't do, but he wasn't a killer, and he didn't really kill anybody. But he had some problems and didn't have a lot of support from too many people. But he managed to pull it off and not get out. But that was thanks to the journalism students from Northwestern that helped him.
You also talked about a case close to home that really affected you by people you knew that were lobbying you on this issue.
That was the grandson of the former governor, Len Small.
Mm-hmm.
He was governor in 1926, Small was, and his grandson lives right out my back door. We're neighbors, been neighbors for years. And he bought a Frank Lloyd Wright house. He inherited a bunch of money, Steve Small did. Of course, he had plenty of money before, but he inherited, somebody died in the family and left him more. and he bought a Frank Lloyd Wright house in Kankakee on the river, really a beautiful place, and re-established it and put all of their proper stuff, went to Europe and got the glass and the different things that needed to be replaced, was redoing it. And one night about midnight, he gets a call from somebody that says, this is the Kankakee Police Department, and we just arrested some people that have attempted to break into your Frank Lloyd Wright house, and if you come over here to the house, well, you can sign the papers. So he got out of bed at midnight, went down, opened his garage door. These people put a gun on him, threw him in the trunk, and took him off out to the eastern part of the state where the soil is kind of sandy and stuff, where they dug a grave, had a casket made for him out of wood, put him in the casket, put him in the grave, and went back and made some calls and asked for $1 million in ransom. Before they put him in there, he called his wife and said, this is no joke. I've been kidnapped, and I need $1 million. Call the bank and get the money, and don't call the police. Well, she called the police and the FBI, and they came there. I was lieutenant governor at the time. And it took a while for them to find it. Took a couple of days to find this guy because he was calling from local phones to find out where his $1 million was. And they finally caught him, and he was a local guy. He and his girlfriend were having some problems with paying off a drug bill or something, and they thought that he would be an easy mark. And he suffocated in the casket that they built for him, and that was it. And he's still in jail, I think. I don't know. He may still be in Pontiac. That's where he was.
Playing the devil's advocate here, Governor. You mentioned during all this going on, 1980, of course, was when the serial killer John Wayne Gacy killed 33 young boys and men. He was executed in 1994. I guess, is that somebody, can we at least agree that somebody like that who was convicted of that, heinous crimes, be put to death?
Well, yeah, but then you got to have the death penalty to do that.
Right.
Oh, if you haven't got a death penalty, you can't put him to death. And I happen to think that life in prison is a tougher sentence than death, frankly. Think about everything you had to do or had done to somebody is probably not the most pleasant thing in the world. But, you know, we're working on it. There's still 28 states that have the death penalty, and we're trying to clear that all up. And the United States is one of the very few countries in the Western democracies that still execute criminals with about 2,600 of them waiting on death row. And on the average, each convict is going to spend about 15 years waiting to be executed, and a quarter of those people will die a natural death before they're ever even given the lethal injection to kill them. So that's the way it is. It's still there, and it's who knows? We may have a lot of innocent people still on death row in some of those states. I would guess we do.
The book is called Until I Could Be Sure, How I Stopped the Death Penalty in Illinois. It's a riveting tale. I enjoyed it. It brought back some memories having lived through this era. The author is former Illinois Governor George Ryan, who's been our guest today, and I'm very gracious he's taken the time to be our guest, and I recommend this book to folks to looking at this very controversial issue and how the governor shows how public opinion has changed on this issue, and it was due largely to the efforts that you kickstarted back then in the late 1990s.
Well, it's one of those issues that I'm going to continue to work on. Now, your books are, by the way, are available at Barnes and Noble and Amazon, and I'm going to try and put together a few signing agreements somewhere around the state. And maybe I'll get around out there in the western part of the state sometime in the next couple of months And if I do, Robin, I'll stop by and you can buy me a cup of coffee.
I'll do that, sir. Well, it was very nice having you on as a guest, and take care of yourself.
Okay. Thanks very much for the call. I appreciate it.